This is the June 18 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Dale Durkles of Grain Cycles out of Bloomington, Illinois, Elaine Cub from ElaineCub.com out of Ipswich, South Dakota, and Mike Zuzla, GlobalAnalytics.biz from Atchison, Kansas. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to our programming on demand anytime you'd like at willag.org, W-I-L-L-A-G. .org. And as we begin, I'd like to thank Dale Durkles for his time serving with WILL as one of our community advisors. Dale, thank you so much. I know that your time has ended in the last week, and we do really appreciate that. Now, let's begin by getting a list of items that we should discuss for the day. We'll start with you, Dale Durkles of Grain Cycles. What's on your mind?
Two things are really on my mind right now. One of them is China and what we're going to see as far as business out of China. And I guess the other one in the mix in here is kind of a combination of crop conditions and weather around the Midwest.
Elaine Cub from ElaineCub.com.
Well, I know that we are all sick and tired of talking about coronavirus, but I think it's interesting to look at how ethanol production is recovering and how that's really an indicator of really the only economic indicator that is affecting our grain markets at the moment.
And Mike Zuzlo.
Probably the biggest things are the spreads right now, Todd. The wheat-corn spread, the bean-wheat spread, and the cattle-hog spreads, all very, very active here in the last few weeks.
Why don't you explain what you mean to me, please?
Well, that would take a whole half-hour program, but I think, generally speaking, we saw on Thursday's trade a real headline news trade across the board. We had seen the Chinese Commerce Ministry release 10,000 tons of pork. They said more could come if they needed it. This really offset a very strong weekly export sales number for the pork side of the equation. And so the headline trade was trading instead of the fundamentals. Same with the weather in the corn versus the wheat. The corn market is very nervous, rightfully so, of a very big miss in the rain systems that are being projected. I would say this is a $1.5 billion rain because I think you could trim the national yield 5 bushels from what USDA is at if we don't get these promised rains over the next 10 days. So the trade naturally took the route of buying corn and selling wheat. And they naturally took that route as well because Russia said they're not going to be looking at doing any kind of export limitation of the wheat market. Beans are hemmed in by the wheat. They're up towards their April highs, but we can't seem to get above that. And I think it's because of the wheat market, because of the currencies, especially the fact that the Brazilian real is starting to go down against the dollar and make new weekly lows or try to make new weekly lows on Thursday's trade as well. So I think for the first time in a while, you can see more of a clear picture. The pond isn't muddy. It's kind of got a clear look to it as far as what the trade is trading while we wait for more news on these more important issues.
Well, let's take up just crop conditions very quickly. There in Atchison, Kansas, the northwestern corner of Kansas, in kind of a prime area, along with Nebraska, Missouri, the southwest corner of Iowa, what are conditions like?
They're better than anywhere else in the state of Kansas at this point, Todd, because we have been blessed with some rains in May that we're still being able to work through and work off of in terms of subsoil moisture. The corn's very nice and green. It's getting very close to waist high pretty uniformly. Population is good except for the low areas that maybe got a little bit of drowned out, but nothing like east of the Mississippi River from what I'm hearing. Soybeans are probably a little shorter than normal, but they're coming on fast. I would say the corn and beans are in good shape in our area. You drive an hour and a half south, southwest, you get into the hard red wheat belt, past Topeka, past Manhattan. I think the custom cutters, since they've crossed the Oklahoma-Kansas border and found better than expected yields, I would expect sincerely, based upon the drought monitor, that we would have a substantial decline in yields as more news came through next week as we get into the heart of the central Kansas wheat belt and then we stretch over towards Colorado and up towards Nebraska. We had zero drought in the state of Kansas last year at this time. We're running at almost 70% at this stage of the game, but it's all the western two-thirds of the state.
Bloomington is in central Illinois. Dale Durkles, what are conditions like in your area?
You know, the one thing I'll say, and even as I've driven around different parts of central Illinois here over the last couple of weeks, is we have a lot of variety. And just yesterday, I traveled from where I live, southeast of Bloomington, to over around southwest of Bloomington. And on that short trip, about 15 miles, I saw corn anywhere from almost knee-high or roughly about knee-high down to corn that was basically 2 inches tall. And that really just kind of illustrates everything that goes on in central Illinois. It's because of the heavy rains we've had at different places, different times during the month of May, and we ended up having an awful lot of replant in some places, whether it was ponds that got replanted or in some cases whole fields. And when you look across the field itself, you see a lot of variety of conditions. You see good-looking crops in a field alongside crops that are struggling. Germination wasn't quite as good. The population looks a little lighter. The plant looks a little yellower, and it's a little shorter in places. So, you know, and that's true of both corn and beans as we travel across a lot of central Illinois.
And then Elaine Cobb, your area is a little bit harder to describe from my point of view, but I'll put you between Mitchell, where the Corn Palace is, and some may very well know, and Jamestown in North Dakota. And you're not very far, I don't think, from the North-South Dakota line. But
that's true.
What are conditions in your area like?
Well, I'll tell you this. I'm jealous of all of you that have got to drive around. Usually by this time of year, I've been all over the Corn Belt. But this year, with everything canceled or going online, I haven't had much of a crop tour. But I will say, sort of echo Dale's comments about the variability and the fact that, you know, there was a non-ideal start in a broad part of the Corn Belt, not just here in the Dakotas, but a lot of the Western Corn Belt had a wet start. And a lot of the planting was late or replanted now that things have dried up and offered that window to get things replanted. I know there will be large quantities of prevented plant acres here in eastern South Dakota and, of course, eastern North Dakota because they were struggling even to get the harvest done. I had a friend just send a picture yesterday, got done with their 2019 corn harvest. So things have not been ideal, but without a crop tour, I can still tell you that we are still expecting a record large corn crop in this nation, and I know that things have dried out over the past week. Nevertheless, the overall nationwide crop condition numbers that you see from the USDA, when you look at this in aggregate, you are looking at a good to excellent crop generally, and Mike talked about needing this $1.5 billion rain in the next 10 days. But that's a big if. You know, we need to look out to a longer portion of time. And the expectation, I think, generally here is still to see a record large 15-something billion bushel crop.
It'll need to be used. And you wanted to talk a little bit about coronavirus and ethanol. I'm wondering whether we can consume very much.
Well, and I wasn't very optimistic about it when you saw how badly the ethanol production numbers collapsed going from February into April. You know, there was that time frame when we were consistently producing over, you know, a million barrels per day, and it dropped down to a low of 537,000 barrels per day. That was at the end of April. And then you expected, well, some people were calling for a V-shaped recession, and some people were expecting to see more of a long-term bottom. But if we look purely at the chart of ethanol production in the United States, that weekly chart, it really does look like a V-shaped recession. The recovery in the number of barrels per day being produced by these nation's ethanol plants is almost as fast as the loss was during that 8-week shock of losing the production. We were losing 67,000 barrels per day each week, and now we're gaining it back at a rate of 43,000 barrels per day per week. So it's not quite as fast of a recovery as it was a loss, but the recovery is still pretty good. And the problem, we can sort of look to China. You know, they're 2 months ahead of us, let's say, in their coronavirus, just dealing with the virus itself as a human pandemic. But our pattern of how our economic usage recovery is going to take place is going to be very different in the United States, because the question remains, some people are going to say, well, it's more important to me to go on my summer vacation and take my summer road trip than it is to avoid this virus. And other people are going to say, well, it's more important for me to stay safe than it is to take my summer road trip. So I'm surprised and pleased by how much of a V-shaped recession or V-shaped recovery we've had in the ethanol production. But I think it's really uncertain to know if we're ever going to really fully recover by the end of the summer.
Mike, I know you're balancing out the near-term rainfall event with the macro events. What do you see?
Well, kind of dovetailing with what Elaine was just talking about, and I think we're really in a sweet spot for demand recovery, both in terms of livestock production and packer capacity coming back online and that energy consumption. But now I think the heavy lifting begins. With the issues of COVID in Beijing, we have to remember that 30% of the world's commodity demand essentially comes from China and or has in the past. And you look at iron ore and copper and soybeans, those numbers go up into the 60% region. So, I mean, when you see that and you see something like a Denny's restaurant and those sit-down chains that the national retail people have just put out some new numbers. And, you know, those numbers for April being down 60-some percent, chains with drive-throughs being down 20%. We've seen a recovery, and it's been a fairly easy recovery in a sense, Todd, that we went too low to begin with when it came to unleaded gas futures and crude oil futures and ethanol futures. But I think this time period between the Memorial Day holiday and the July 4th holiday is going to be extremely important for the overall commodity demand to continue to rebuild, whether it's the summer driving season or the summer grilling season. So I'm very much on pins and needles because I think the demand recovery has been mostly government money stimulated. And as I said, in the futures market, it was almost easy pickings for the futures market to be able to cover shorts when you had negative $40 a barrel crude oil and you thought that and said that the demand was going to be zero for the year 2020.
Dale, this week, U.S. Trade Representative Lighthizer was before the Senate Finance Committee, and he said that he thought China would get close to meeting the Phase One trade deal. That will be important for agriculture over the next several months and going into the 2021 season. How do you see it playing out?
Can I pull out my crystal ball and see what kind of murky, cloudy picture that gives us? You know, there are a lot of uncertainties in it, you know, and to follow up even with Lighthizer's comments, there were some somewhat positive comments that came out of the meeting yesterday Pompeo had with a Chinese official in Hawaii regarding, you know, the trade pact and some of the purchases China intends to make in here and their ability or at least their desire to live up to the pact itself. So, you know, everybody is talking positively about it. The real question becomes, do we really finally end up, you know, fulfilling or meeting those goals that they laid out in that pact? And I think it's just too uncertain. We see some areas where things seems to be a little bit positive in terms of the trade and Chinese buying. Pork seems to be getting regenerated once again here, and I think that's going to be a plus for us. And you know, Europe's always been a bigger or generally been a bigger supplier of pork to China than we have here in the U.S., but with this trade pact in place, we could see that flip around. So pork could actually end up getting some benefit. With Brazil, the aggressive shipping campaign they had here via their harvest this last spring, and they've shipped so aggressively, you know, they're going to start to wind down here pretty quickly to me, and that means the U.S. is going to have to come in and fulfill the bean needs China has. And certainly, you know, China's going to have needs. There was just some numbers out here, you know, showing growth in the hog herd in China itself, up about 4%, I think it was, on the month, you know, here in April. So we're seeing demand base grow in China, and I think that puts us in reasonably good stead going forward, you know, as far as will we be able to meet the details of that trade pact. I don't know that we'll really get there totally, but I think we're going to probably try to get pretty close to it. One thing just to back up what both Elaine and Mike was talking about here, one thing I watch each week when we talk about ethanol is, you know, the finished gasoline supplied to the market, because that's really a key barometer, and it seems to have shifted a little bit sooner in terms of the collapse, and then turned around, rebounded, and actually even sharper than the ethanol grind itself actually rebounded. We're up roughly at about 8 billion barrels. And, you know, before we had things shut down because of coronavirus, we were somewhere a little bit above 9. So, you know, the question going forward here during the summer months is going to be, how much more gas demand can we generate? Because are people still going to travel as much? I think there's going to be a lot more car vacations this year, less airline vacations this year. That says a plus, but car vacations could be a little closer too. And so that doesn't necessarily mean we get a lot more gasoline demand. And then you look at, you know, companies maybe finally starting to go back to work. I think we're going to have a huge cadre of employees out there that are still going to work from home. So that's going to tend to give some set of an offset to that. So I like what Mike said, and I think he said it well. We're now into a point, you know, we've done the easy part of the rebound, and now we're up to the heavy lifting.
The grain stocks are due out at the end of the month, Elaine Cub. It'll be interesting to see how USDA manage this and what those who store grain across the United States, because really it's mostly an accounting of what's available in trying to figure out just exactly how much is consumed and really what happened in the livestock industry and how that plays into that number. Do you have expectations?
Yeah, I will say that I am expecting to see probably larger than usual on-farm stocks, and that's just a reflection of the farmer selling patterns that have been noted in recent months, which have been pretty slow. And that's not only true for the old crop, but of course for new crop, where the expectation is that farmers have not been selling much at these not very exciting prices. And I think it's also backed up when you look at the nationwide basis patterns. You know, saying an average basis is kind of meaningless, but the average nationwide basis right now is 22 cents under the July futures. And that's pretty strong for this time of year. It's especially strong sort of along that Illinois Riverway, obviously before the locks get shut down, everybody's scrambling to get stuff moved there. It's strong all throughout the Eastern Corn Belt. There's, you know, overs in Ohio still, where they're still struggling from low supplies from the 2019 year. And it's even strong out here in the Western Corn Belt. It's stronger than usual when we talk about old crop. So that backs up that expectation to see more of it stored on farm. But of course, that just means we're kicking the can down the road of still waiting for some price that will compel farmers to move this grain.
We can't wait very much longer, I wouldn't think, Mike Zuzulo. How do farmers deal with what they've got in the bin?
Well, I think the positive side of the equation is with coronavirus that a lot of producers had basis contracts locked in, and they did a lot more than normal from what I can tell, not just on my deck, but I think in a lot of people's decks, a lot more basis contracts. So we're really playing the futures rally. I think there are going to be a lot of producers letting go of substantial amounts of corn as we get to the first notice day on the 29th or 30th of this month. So I think the clock is ticking, and it makes sense because you've got your weather market starting to try to be drilling some premium here in that 345 level in Dease, and that 335 level in the July are 2 points that are kind of resistance from the April highs. And if we can get above those levels, then we start talking about getting into the March time period, getting back to those pre-COVID levels. And it makes sense that weather would have to do that for us as we do go through this demand rebuilding, because the demand destruction in the marketplace, at least, was very, very rapid, and the rebuilding always takes a long time. So my mindset is you get above 335 in July corn, it's pretty easy technically to see 345 to 350. That's where I think open orders need to be in place here for the next week.
Your cash strategy, Dale?
I think Mike probably hit it pretty well on the head there. I think there's an awful lot of stuff out there that is on a basis contract. There's some that isn't. You have people that are in different situations. You go in central Illinois, you know, and you go beyond roughly July 1 and the locks start to shut down. You know, it's either corn's going to have to go east or the corn's going to have to go west. You know, and so we got a core of people there that have some unique circumstances to deal with all the way up into central Illinois. And I think that's one thing people got to be very cognizant of as we march here through the rest of the month of June, is that, you know, how do I plan for that river to be shut down? Although I think at this point, probably when you look at some of the different cash bids out there, even for July and beyond, you know, they probably have already factored a lot of that in there. And, you know, so the merchandising industry has already pre-planned some of that. But I, like Mike, you know, you get upwards of 345, maybe into 350, you know, you really got to start turning loose with some stuff, especially if you're in an area with good basis levels. One point back to the corn stocks report itself that we've got to keep in mind at this point is that, you know, we're going to find something out with that June corn stocks number that we really haven't had a good feel for yet. And that's called the quality of last year's corn crop. They tend not to show up in the winter reports themselves, but when we get to the June finally and we've moved enough of that crop out of the bin on the farm, farmers have a better feel for what they still have in the bin out there, you know, in terms of a little bit lighter test weight than what they're used to, and their eyeballs out of adjustment trying to estimate how many bushels of corn they had in the bin on the prior reports themselves. So be a little careful about that particular report, because if test weight was light, that means farmer inventories will be down a little bit. And some of this corn I've heard, you know, over the last month anyway, moving into ethanol plants that have started to ramp up once again, they're finding that, you know, the production out of the corn they're getting isn't quite as good, owing again, you know, to getting in some light test weight corn for some different areas. And if that's the case, you know, your consumption in terms of bushels, whether you're talking about grinding for ethanol or putting it through a hog or a cow, is a little bit stronger than what people really think about at this point. And that's one thing that people are going to have to think about in trying to define, you know, what kind of number the USDA may be getting ready to give us here at the end of the month. One other thing that I want to mention as far as reports are concerned, and I think towards the end of the month, maybe the most important report we have comes on, I think it's the 25th, the quarterly hogs and pigs report. That is one report I do not have a feel for how you put together a set of expectations, because we had so many things happen tied up with the shutdown and slaughter capacity a couple of months there, that how many hogs were euthanized, how many hogs were just put on a low maintenance feed, how many sows were headed off into the slaughter mix themselves, what portion of those were bred sows that ended up in the slaughter mix. They're just how many baby pigs that were born, you know, farrowed out and just immediately euthanized. We have so many unknowns. I don't know how anybody puts together a set of expectations for it. And so be prepared, not only from a hog standpoint, but the implications back to the demand for grain themselves. There could be some interesting numbers coming on that hog and pig report.
Doesn't recent history, though, Dale, tell you that the number of hogs in the system will remain about the same?
What do you mean about the same, though?
Well, they don't. I mean, so many of these are contracted, it seems to me that they continue to fill the barns one way or the other.
Be very careful about that, because when we were in the heat of the shutdown of slaughter pines, I was hearing about bred sows being slaughtered. You know, and the other thing, when you go back and you look at it, you look at the percentage base of sow slaughter, it's up a lot this year, has been going all the way back into the winter months themselves. And, you know, when those slaughter plants started to shut down and we were having problems with coronavirus, because I'm dealing with a system, if I'm a hog producer, that's got a constant flow coming in the door, going out the door. I've got uncertainty in here of getting animals out the door. So what do I do? Do I try to figure out what to do with those, or do I slow down the number of animals coming in, which means, do I actually euthanize baby pigs? Do I actually send to slaughter some bred sows? We have no feel for any of that at this point in time. And it may not be a long hole in the slaughter itself, but it could be enough that it could have implications when we get out into the winter months, you know, the number of hogs that we're going to have coming into the slaughter pipeline. We just don't know, because everything that happened isn't quantifiable. That's the real difficulty of this. How do you quantify, you know, the number of animals that get euthanized, whether you're talking slaughter-ready hogs or whether you're talking about baby pigs? And nobody tracks the number of bred sows that end up coming into the slaughter pipeline for sows themselves. So we just have no feel for what happened back there. The USDA numbers will be the first good accounting that we'll see of this.
Elaine Cubb, just slightly different topic, actually a lot different topic. You mentioned that there would be some prevent plant acres in your area. What do you expect for the acreage figures released at the end of the month?
That I again, it's just sort of like, it is sort of a related topic to Dale's topic in that you can get a government report, but it's not going to tell you exactly what you want to know. That hogs and pigs report, we're going to have to back off and do some math, but we're never going to know exactly what the cull was. It will just be an implied number. And the prevent plant is sort of a similar scenario where if you had FSA's data on July 15th, you might come up with a confident number, but otherwise we have to wait for some WASDE report and try and come up with some implied math.
Mike, what do you have to say on these two subjects?
Just real briefly, I think your points, both points are really well taken on the hog side, because I think contract numbers are solid. They're set in most cases. There are some people that I work with that the contract numbers are not set. The numbers that the packers and the growers that are in charge will go ahead and take that number, and the contract numbers are set in most cases. It's the contract price that is not. And so I think we were really on the edge of losing a lot of young animals. That has been prevented at this stage of the game. But I think that much like everything else in this economy since COVID, is that the excess capital has been worn out and banks are now getting tighter and tighter and tighter in terms of allowing you more freedom to continue to operate at a loss, whether it's 10%, 20%, or 30%, it's still a loss and they're not going to let it go on forever. And I think this boils down to why I think the livestock market ultimately is going to be whether we have a good corn price or a bad corn price, and that we will walk our corn off the fields in a mindset that if we have good protein markets, if we don't lose a lot of restaurants in the next 3 months, then the protein demand won't go down at the retail level. If we don't have a lot of lost permanent jobs and we can get the restaurants back up and running because COVID didn't resurge, we won't lose protein demand. But if you flip those upside down, you've got two big reasons why protein demand will continue to slip. I read an article this week that lending to restaurants that are not helped out by major capital and major hedge funds are seeing interest rates of at least 25% on operating income. You can't tolerate that for more than a couple, 3 months. So this is what we're going through right now. This is where that heavy lifting comes in. On the acreage report, very briefly, I still feel like we're under 96 on the corn, and I still feel like we're over 85 on the beans. Just because the USDA pushed it too hard on their acreage report to begin with, and because some of the prevent plant and some of the replant that we're going to have to see, and a lot of corn seed that got used up probably went into soybeans with the shift in the marketplace with the U.S.-China trade negotiations looking like they were improving. So I don't know if we'll get that on June 30th or not.
We'll close out our time together, of course, by getting a final word from each of you. Dale Durkles from Grain Cycles out of Bloomington, Illinois. Your final word, please.
You know, the one thing I think here with the reports coming up at the end of the month and with the current soil moisture situation and then the promised weather that we've got ahead in here, just prepare for a fair amount of volatility, whether you're looking at the livestock sector or you're looking at the grain markets themselves, both, you know. So I think we're going to get ready to go through a volatile summer. The one thing I will go back and say, though, when I look at the corn market, the low we put in place back in April, to me, because it had all the emotional makeup and the emotional ingredients to go with it, is probably going to end up standing up as a 5.5-year low. So I think we might have passed the low water mark at this point, the complicating issue. We have a 24, 26-month cycle that comes back and haunts us and is due to bottom at the end of the calendar year. So there's a possibility we could see corn prices, once we get into harvest themselves, come back and retest where we were here on the depths in back in April.
Elaine Cubb from ElaineCubb.com.
Just cautious optimism, and to sort of back up what Dale was just saying about probably having seen the lows in a lot of this markets, all of the data sets we see, this recovery in ethanol and a similar recovery, honestly, in the hog slaughter numbers, where you got 460,000 head per day, which is not what it used to be, but it's a pretty good recovery from the lows we saw in April. all of that sort of leads us to believe that we're heading on the right path and the lows may be behind us for a lot of these ag markets.
And Mike Zuzulo at globalanalytics.biz.
Very simply put, if we can get underneath that 3 billion bushel carryover for 2021 on corn in the United States, I think the South American supplies are going to be tight enough that the market will open up the upside, Todd. So that's really the key when we turn the corner into July, whether it's because of weather or it's because of USDA's numbers. We've got to start with getting below 3 billion bushels come June 30th and in July 1st.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to the whole of the program anytime you'd like on demand right there on our website at willag.org, or look for it as a podcast in your favorite podcast applications. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Mike Zuzulo at globalanalytics.biz out of Atchison, Kansas, Elaine Cub from elainecub.com out of Ipswich, South Dakota, and Dale Durkles of Grain Cycles out of Bloomington, Illinois. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.